Hello and welcome to the Awaken to Wholeness Summit. I'm Val Salidkar. Today I'm really excited to launch this entire journey with one of the most important conversations I feel we can have in this moment, because it sets the context for everything else. This is the story of the universe story. And it's my deep honor to welcome Dr. Mary Evelyn Tucker and Dr. John Grimm with us today. And let me tell you a little bit about these two amazing, amazing people who have just made such a difference in our world. Mary Evelyn and John Grimm are both senior lecturers and research scholars at Yale University. They teach in a master's program in religion and ecology and founded and direct the Forum on Religion and Ecology at Yale, which arose from a series of 10 conferences held from 1996 to 1998 at Harvard Center for the Study of World Religions. They are series editors of the 10 volumes that were published and distributed by Harvard University Press. Mary Evelyn is a specialist in East Asian religions, especially Confucianism. John is a specialist in indigenous traditions, especially Native American religions. They're both authors of several groundbreaking books. Along with cosmologist Brian Swim, who's also part of our summit, Tucker and Grimm created a multimedia project titled Journey of the Universe that includes a book, an Emmy award-winning film, and a series of in-depth conversations. They're now offering online classes from Yale, drawing on these materials and on the worldview of Thomas Berry, who inspired Journey of the Universe. Together, they edited Living Cosmology, Christian Responses to the Journey of the Universe. Mary Evelyn and John, welcome. I can't tell you how wonderful it is to launch the summit with both of you.
Good to be with you, Val.
Thank you so much for hosting all of this.
Absolutely. I feel this project, and you guys have already done so much leading up to Journey of the Universe, but I feel like Journey of the Universe is a real game changer. You know, it really invites us to understand ourselves, to deepen our perspective about who we are and how we've unfolded over the past 13.7 billion years, you know, this evolutionary journey. It's just such a powerful invitation.
It is, Val, and it makes me think also of all those elders who are behind us here and at our shoulders, all those mineral, plant, animal, and human elders who brought us to understanding that we're talking about today.
Yeah, and I love your enthusiasm for the story because, as we all know, stories inspire us. We want to hear each other's stories, and there's nothing like a great novel. And I think this was Thomas Berry's key idea, that we've got to take this extraordinary amount of science that we now have available, from physics and astrophysics through geology and biology and ecology and the human part of our story. And he was saying, we need to understand this not separately, but together as an unfolding dynamic sequence in which we participate, we come out of, we're born out of, but in which we now participate. That's the excitement, isn't it, of a universe story.
Absolutely. And to really understand that the entire unfolding universe is one, you know, just one event that just keeps unfolding, you know, that we're all part of it and it's all part of us. And it really does invite us into a deeper understanding of who we are, how to live our lives, giving us such rich meaning and purpose.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a great story, a great work, as Thomas Berry would say. The story drives the action.
And it's a wonderful challenge that we feel even in your use of the word one journey or one story. And yet it's charged with difference. And in the last 50 years, our philosophical colleagues have yearned to awaken us to that sense of difference. And so we have that wonderful paradox of it's a unific whole story, and yet it's charged with all of the difference that seems to give it creativity also.
Yeah. Part of the invitation, of course, is this last book that you mentioned. We have a huge conference here at Yale. Well, how are the Christian traditions of exploring this and responding to it? Is this true with Buddhism, Taoism and all the other traditions. But I also want to say that our colleague and dear friend for 40 years, Brian Swim, brings to this project not only his great creativity in narrating, but and his scientific expertise of years of studying this. But he himself is Native American, and he brings, his father is Native from the Salish people of British Columbia. And he brings that sense that Sean's just mentioned of this is a story which includes everyone, but can be told differently by peoples around the world. And this is just the beginning of that, the differentiated telling of the story.
It makes me think of Joseph Campbell in some ways, and you know, as a comparative mythologist, and how he looked into the deeper meaning of the stories. The characters were different, you know, based on the time and the civilization and the culture. But underneath it, there's sort of a deeper calling, a deeper understanding of this continuous story of, you know, us as star stuff. You know, there's, it's inside of everything.
Yes, and we feel the question of meaning certainly draws humans and our reflexive consciousness. And that sense of story also, to see it in the world around us, that the meaning may sometimes dispose us exclusively towards the human and our capacities, but story opens us up to the world around us. Everything is narrating, telling its story.
It's so true.
The poets and artists understand this, don't they? They're trying to capture some of the story. There's a great phrase of William Blake that says, catch the love as it flies. As the winged creatures, the gilled creatures, the two-leggeds, the four-leggeds, and so on. Again, which Indigenous peoples understood extremely well.
Mm. Absolutely. So I wonder how, in your own lives, how did you come into the universe story and make that such a central point of your own work?
I come from North Dakota, and so I grew up in a part of the world where Lakota and Dakota and Nakota people in that region, the different dialectical groups of people, they say Plains people are dreamers. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I've seen myself as a dreamer. It's woven into my DNA. And I first encountered personal experiences that awakened me to the fragmentation of the world and a sense of a world that was falling apart. And where do you go? What place do you go to begin to find the world or put the world back together again? And so I was yearning in my undergraduate study of history and religious studies or the history of religions to then go and study with Thomas Berry. And he oriented both of us into the study of religion with an ear towards hearing the story or the cosmologies of traditions, because in those stories, he found a deep values embedded, which would open up what we would call cultures or a people's worldview or a sense of that which motivated them and carried them forward. So for me, it was place, story, and study with Thomas Berry.
Now, just to pick up that thread, because of course when Thomas comes into the conversation, we all get energized. But I had that same feeling as many of us did in the 60s after a lot of activism and civil rights and the anti-Vietnam War, and I went to college in Washington, D.C. But after Nixon was elected, I left the country actually and said I wasn't coming back until we had the new administration. And 2 years later, after I'd gone to Japan to teach, I come to the subway station in Tokyo after a Zen retreat. I see the headlines, Nixon resigns. I knew I could come home. But during that period of disillusionment and a sense of feeling suffering of the world, ranging from our own domestic issues, civil rights, to the Vietnam War, and trying to sense where are we going as a planetary people, I came across Teilhard de Chardin. I had read him in high school, but barely understood him. And he gave me, in this Japanese context, a renewed sense of, wow, the depth and the struggle even of evolution to come forth. And yet Teilhard's optimism, his sense of hope, even in that struggle, as he was in the First World War and seeing enormous destruction around him as a stretcher bearer, but he could still sense something was emerging. greater complexity, greater consciousness, was Teilhard's way of putting it. And at that time, I was also trying to study and understand the traditions of Japan, East Asia, Buddhism and Confucianism and Shinto and so on. And I wrote to Thomas Berry. I had some of his articles before I left. And the miracle of my life is he wrote back.
And nothing was ever the same.
Exactly. And when I came back to the States, I went to meet Thomas Berry, and through Thomas Berry, met John, and we were students together at Fordham.
He was our matchmaker.
A matchmaker, teacher, colleague, friend, inspiration.
Brian loves to make the statement that Thomas's students fell in love with each other. Thomas was introducing them to the universe and the love in the universe.
It's all about falling in love. Yeah. I love it. And so here's the common thread here is Thomas Berry.
Yes.
You know, Thomas actually has come up in several conversations in the summit, and I would love for you to share with everybody a little bit about who Thomas Berry is, his incredible contribution to our world, and how he inspired you in your own work.
He's a person of, as he would say, low energy, a North Carolinian who had a gentle and peaceful manner, and yet a deep, intense burning of his intellectual drive, and an even deeper drive, I would say, to feel at the cusp of new thought. He loved pushing himself towards new thought. I feel Thomas is someone who abides in us, in his manner that he, his tone of voice and his style of thinking. It's hard to find words exactly to describe that, the fullness of that exchange. But I would start with where I first encountered Thomas was his attention to cultural difference. And that expressed itself especially in the phrase world religions, or which now it's both much contested and rethought. I myself like to rethink the concept of world religions as religions of the world, and it's certainly influenced by Thomas. But in that, at that moment, he was not focused on the ecological or environmental dimension, but rather the sense of people's meeting one another. So the early encounter with world history and the overarching patternings of civilizations meeting one another. But to just go to a particular dimension of his thinking, namely the dialogue of religions, I still find people who have varieties of perspective, many of them very creative and very thoughtful, but I still find Thomas's position on this very challenging. And he came to an understanding that religions complete one another. And so when I first met Thomas Berry and I began the study of Buddhism and Confucianism and Taoism and so forth, that it was not simply as academic organizations out there, but rather as living, vital wisdom traditions that said something to one another that the other lacked. And that engaged me a great deal. That's deeply, it continues to be meaningful to me when I consider other traditions as saying something to me that's bringing me forward.
Yeah, as his students and colleagues for so many years, for 40 years really, he was first and foremost a cultural historian. He studied the history of the West. He did his dissertation on Vico, a philosopher of history, where he understood the ages of the human. He was a monk. He was part of a religious order. He understood the cycles of the daily movement of the sun. He understood the cosmological rhythms that oriented solstice and Christmas together. So these were all part of who he was. But just as we were meeting him, John met him earlier in 68, and I met him in 75, coming back from Japan. And he was beginning to pull together not only this long, long journey of his through the world's religions, through the study of their languages. He taught both of us Sanskrit. We read the Bhagavad Gita with him and so on. He had studied Chinese traditions, and he gave me this deep sense of Confucianism, one of his favorite, and gave John the tremendous feeling for indigenous traditions. But at that time, about in the mid-70s, he was beginning to formulate the sense of a story.
Already by 71, too.
Good. Yeah. In any case, it's a long journey, because he was saying we don't have a story that's orienting us right now. Mm-hmm. He tried to think this through with science, a religious cultural sensibility, and his first essay, 1978, on this, The New Story, which was published, of course, 10 years later in Dream of the Earth, is a seminal, important essay. It's up on our website. We have a website for Thomas Berry. All of his talks and videos are up there, and as well that article and some of his other articles. It's also on the Journey of the Universe website. But that was seminal.
Yes, and just to touch on an earlier point you made, in 1964, Thomas gave a keynote lecture to a conference on Teilhard de Chardin, and the American Teilhard Association would come out of that conference, and he was president from 74 to 87. So already in the mid-60s, the point you're making about deep time, Thomas was already working in that context. Much of his teaching was on cultural history and the meaning of religious traditions and the specificity of traditions. But by early 70s, he was beginning to bring the two together. He was positioning these traditions in their stories of deep time, so not necessarily evolutionary time, but rather cultural narratives of deep time. And then the question of what is our story?
Yes.
And what's our story of deep time, such as we find in these other traditions?
Yeah, I think to pick up that point and just carry it forward, he was influenced by Teilhard, as were we. We're going to celebrate John's 30 years as president, actually, this coming spring in May. That sense that we need a deep vision that has scientific, ecological grounding, and cosmological significance. In other words, cosmology is not just the study of the early universe, as scientists like to claim. Cosmology is embedded in stories of our origin, where we've come from, why we're here, where we're going. And these are the vital questions, aren't they? As young people, we all discussed, and we still are trying to find our way. Yeah. But this sense that is irreversible, once we get a glimpse of it, and it's a glimpse because it's so profound, of how we have come out of stardust, how our own Earth has formed over 4.6 billion years, how the first cell took a billion years, multicellular life, 2 billion years. This sense of deep time changes everything in terms of how we belong. It decenters the human and recenters the human, I think.
And there are these strands parallel to Teilhard de Chardin, such as process thought from a Whitehead that John Cobb has so successfully developed, that also provide the sense of a look into deep time and the sense of existent reality telling the story of that, that journey through deep time.
Yes, and it's great to mention that, John, because of course, like the eco-feminists, many of them have drawn on this story. Yes. Sally McVeig has, Rosemary Ruther has. So the story is coming from a number of different angles and so on. But there's a groundswell now, even in philosophy, of new materialism, vital materialism, that matter is not dead. It's alive, it's moving, it's transforming itself. And that was Teilhard's huge contribution, the interiority of matter. And that there's a sense of an acorn becoming an oak, that there's an interior movement forward towards this greater complexity and consciousness.
One of the deep problems that Teilhard experienced was his own discomfort with a cosmology that had a fixed moment of emergence. And it suggested then a patterning put in place in that emergence, the Genesis story, as a patterning that then enables insight into all further time or the dimensions of the journey. For Teilhard, that was deeply dissatisfying, because while patterning appealed to him and the sense of interiority. I think his use of the word consciousness, a synonym for me is patterning. And that that sense of patterning continuing over time is a cosmogenesis. Right. So rather than a first genesis, an ongoing creating.
Birthing. Yeah.
And what Thomas picked up in this first, or put out, I should say, in his first essay, The New Story, was this sense of differentiation, subjectivity, and communion. Meaning, of course, as John said several times, a tremendous differentiation of nature and culture needs to be highlighted from the beginning. But then this subjectivity, this interiority, the ensouled quality of the world and ourselves, and that resonance, that possibility for resonance, is what makes for the basis of communion, of interrelationship, why we feel the beauty of a sunset, the power of moonlight, the romance of stars and so on and so forth. There's a resonance with humans and all reality.
And it's important too to sense that Thomas did not situate differentiation, subjectivity, and communion as a sequence of progressive movements, but rather all of them, differentiation, subjectivity, and communion, themselves interacting and moving in this journey forward. So he was not a progressivist type of thinker in that sense. Teilhard has much more of that sense of a movement that's culminating in some type of harmonization or within the human. But Thomas was never situated in that. He was much more of a cosmogenesis or process thinker in that sense, although he himself would strongly emphasize the form of reality. He was fascinated with that philosophical or classical term, the form of things in the midst of change. So I'm also struck in my own studies with the native people. So many of their languages are verbals, and I'm making somewhat of a jump here, but the point I'm after is language that is based upon verbals or an event-filled world that's coming at, always rising up to a person, rather than a fixed reality that one points out as objects in the world, that English is very problematic as a language for describing this journey, which is unfolding as we are in that journey itself.
Yeah, another point to pick up here is in the conversations that we have as part of the Journey of the Universe trilogy, the book, the film, and conversations, a wonderful scientist, Ursula Goodenough, who's president of the Cell Biology Society, she teaches at Washington University. But this comes back to interiority, how everything's speaking to us. Now, what she says in that conversation is really astonishing, because she says even the cell has a sense of self. And she defines it in terms of motility, movement, and replicability, and so on. So she's got certain criteria for it. This is amazing. You see, what we're understanding, that indigenous peoples and other cultures understood, was there's sentience, there's some kind of deep subjectivity within matter, the cell, and even beyond. I mean, these books that are coming out from scientists are very interesting. How forests think, this interrelationship of forests and roots and so on.
Yeah,
right?
Do glaciers listen?
Yes, and what we're very excited to bring into the conversation.
Yes, Robin Kimmer, the Potawatomi botanist who speaks of braiding sweetgrass and this whole intimacy of exchange with the natural world as we see ourselves as part of it, interacting. The sense then of the journey as opening possibilities is remarkably like a dream in that sense. We have a sense of journeying or moving in our dream, but it's constantly innovative and it's constantly drawing us forward with a utter sense of spontaneity. So we're in it. Yeah?
Yes, and I think that's a great transition to the concern of this summit towards, well, how do we activate this in ourselves? How do we realize these ideas? I think this is crucial. In other words, the ideas have been bubbling, haven't they, for several decades, and people get it. And your other wonderful participants are way ahead in understanding this. So I think maybe what John's also suggested, how do we imbibe these ideas into ourselves? Again, some of the people in these conversations are suggesting how we do it. Like Tyler is talking about really understanding relationship to stars and so on. So there's one aspect where our consciousness is deepened. Our consciousness is changed. We understand this. We're amazing paradigm shift. And then how does this affect our action? The more we imbibe, I think, this elixir of generativity, of fecundity of the universe, we will have increased creativity for finding our alignment with Earth's processes. And this is exploding. Again, the conversation is illustrated because we invited people for whom the story, the epic of evolution matters, for whom Thomas Berry's ideas matter. And they were saying, well, then we create eco-cities. We work on transformative energy. We work on food and agriculture, permaculture. We work on new education, obviously the new politics and so on. But the key thing is this alignment. And I'll just conclude my enthusiastic outburst here. This is, of course, about human energy, and it's about the physical energy that we're trying to find the alternatives for. So the alternative energies of solar, of wind, of geothermal are this deep alliance with the powers of the universe, which Brian has articulated so well. But the powers of the universe are inviting us into energy, forms of energy for civilization, as well as for transformative energy for the human spirit, because burnout, despair, disempowerment, sadness is so widespread. We understand this. So how are we going to replenish our own wellsprings of energy for the creative work ahead? And Journey of the Universe is an offering to that.
And that's Val. Please, I wanted to say something about the paradox of engagement, but please, if there's a question.
Well, I'd love to, if you could give us a sense, because everything you're saying is so right on. And for some people, they may not really understand or really get how the unfolding of the universe brought us to this moment. And I wonder if you could kind of give us a sense of that so that we can feel into the story and into everything that you're saying. By understanding the movement of the great event. So like the beginning of the journey of the universe gets into the unfolding of life, right? The explosion, the great flaring forth. Can we talk a little bit about that and into the emergence of life and like bring us through this journey to just give us a sense of where we are?
Each moment in the journey, of course, draws forth the sense in my mind of a feast day, a festival day, reflecting back on the story so that at that moment when the uniform, after the initial flaring forth of the universe and the sense of a very smooth and a uniform universe that suddenly rippled and changed, that very early from probably the first 300,000 years of the universe, a sudden change occurred, which still puzzles those scientists to explore the early moment of the universe. And that sense of perhaps the dynamics within the interiority of matter itself, that inner dynamic of the quantum world expressed itself outward into the universe itself and caused this ripple or this wave of activity, which brought forth all of the disruption of you and I and rising sun and setting sun. That sense that what happened in that early moment of the universe gave rise to all that we know, the possibility of all that we know. And again, it's the paradox strikes me of the quiescence that we search for, the seeming peacefulness of quiet, unmoved, unchanging reality. And yet we encounter this wonderful paradox that the universe was this uniform, smooth expression that rippled and changed into to use the Sanskrit term, the prakriti, or the dynamic world, which is something that we now have to deal with very seriously. And many of the religions are characterized as wanting to flee this dynamic world and find this peace again. But the question is, the early universe tells us they are embedded in one another, that the early uniform universe gave rise to the disruption also. So from the very beginning, that would be my first step into this paradox of engagement. What's the quiescent, peaceful, the holistic world that we yearn so much for, and how do we use that perspective to see into the world of dynamic change, the cosmogenesis, and not flee from one or the other, but that paradox of engagement that also calls for a deep sacrifice. And think of that early universe to the Mary Evelyn's example of the cell earlier, and Ursula Goodenough characterizing the cell as a self that protects, nurtures, and reproduces. So she's committed to that term, the idea of a self, and yet how paradoxical to think of our bodies as multiple cells. Those selves then give over to a uniform John Grimness, or I mean, each of our unique person. What happens in that exchange where the multiple selves give over? And so that engagement, the paradox of how we go forward, dealing with the quiescent and the active, and dealing with the self that has demands upon us, and yet we learn how to step back and let the self also find its own interior and its own peace.
Yes, I think so many of these traditions have that dynamic of contemplation and action, right? And that's what many religious leaders offer to us. How do we have it enhance our interiority that's there in great richness? How do we ground ourselves? And what are the rituals that help ground ourselves amidst dynamic, changing reality? But also to pick up on John's point of the sacrificial dimension of the universe. I mean, sacrifice means to make holy, which I like to think of with a W or an H, to make whole, to make ourselves holy. You know, we're on the healing edge of things, we're not the cutting edge and so on, but how do we re-inhabit that dimension of the whole? Amidst creativity, T.S. Eliot said it beautifully, to be still and still moving and so on. So it's why we need the arts, why we need the meditative traditions, why we need this creativity. But I want to come back too to say sacrifice is one of the most challenging things for our time, because we're an indulgent, materialist, consumer-oriented society in the West by and large, and we really don't have a sense fully of what it means to sacrifice. But this chaos and creativity that, like a yin-yang, are so much part of these processes, they're part of ourselves almost every day. Mm. So how we manage that in a healthy yin-yang form is part of our challenge. But moving towards change then, we have to realize something very, very deep about loss, about the mourning of an era, for sure, the mourning of certainty. And it's why we are caught between these various fundamentalisms and a movement forward.
So let's talk a little bit about that. Let's talk about this. Okay, Thomas Berry talks about the fact that we're in between two stories, right?
Yes.
And we're looking forward to the story that we're talking about, this unfolding universe story, and everything that you guys are sharing so eloquently. So what are we up against? You know, when we look around our world, it is very intense. We are suffering. The world is suffering, our inner world, our outer world. We don't really have a sense of ourselves. We're kind of floundering around trying to create some kind of meaning. We're lost inside this materialistic, consumeristic world. So how did we get there? When we're talking about this beautiful story and this first single cell appearing in the primordial ocean, and you know, this sense of differentiation and discernment, and you know, all these sort of sensory developments happening, and awareness on some levels that becomes more complex and complicated, and everything seems so divine and perfect and unfolding in this magical way. And then here come the humans, you know? And the self-reflexive consciousness that we have, this ability to reflect upon ourselves in this amazingly curious way and, you know, create, right? So here we are with this, you know, still in the midst of this unfolding story, creating such devastation, such chaos, such cataclysm, and we're in the midst of all of this right now. How did we get here? How did we get here? What's happening in our moment?
I'll leave the dark and chaos to Mary Evelyn now. I want to talk about the light.
It's an important thing, I think, for us to talk a little bit about, because it's not, we're in it so much, I think so many, that we don't think about it and have the deeper conversations about it often enough in general, in the general world, in the general population, that this is an opportunity for us to really dive into those questions and say, well, what is happening around us now?
Take it away.
I'm referencing Thomas again and to many of my remarks, but he was a teacher who left impression upon all of us. And he was very taken with the term authenticity and the authentic. And I'm intrigued by his foresight in so far as we now wrestle with that concept again, and the basic question, where is authenticity located within us or within the society that we're in or within the world itself? And why would we exclude one or the other? But Thomas posed the question often for us in the context of, say, East Asian traditions, where he would talk about Taoism and a primary commitment to personal engagement with the authentic, that the Tao was that which rose up in the world, and one then had to engage it directly to experience the Tao. And the difficulty, of course, of any articulation, it's an ineffable experience of the primary authenticity of the world. And on the Confucian side, cultivation. Authenticity, certainly in the heaven-earth human configuration, there isn't a primal authenticity, but it's lost or it's dulled and it needs to be cultivated. So Thomas was constantly playing in trying to bring us to think about these two traditions, and certainly Buddhism enters into that mix also, as exploring these questions of authenticity. I think sometimes now about the primal flaring forth of the universe and the experience in the 60s at the Bell Laboratories in New Jersey of Penzias and Wilson, who with their instrumentation set up to read the microwaves in the coming from the stars or from the outer universe, and they had this background noise that they couldn't get out of their instrumentation. And it was some time before we began to realize that is the energy from the primal flaring forth which pervades the universe. And that sense of light then, or of the religious traditions, often using the term light to talk about that realization of deep authenticity. And here we find from the 70s and 80s on, by virtue of the expansion of the universe, an awareness that there is energy and matter that we do not perceive. We now call it dark matter, dark energy, but it stands in relationship to all visible matter, which is a very small part of the universe. And the depth and the profundity, at least in this moment, in my thinking, is what we cannot see. And I sense that's part of our question with engagement, too. We see what rises up in front of us, and it either puts us in horror of the situation, or it's like being in a pleasant dream. It's everything we could hope for. But the realities are, we're confronted by that which we don't know. And the probing question that I experienced in my teacher, Thomas Berry, was also an openness to that constant quest for the dark matter, the dark energy, that which surrounds us, and yet we do not have awareness of, we are not aware of yet, and yet it is moving us, it is shaping us. Is that, I'm not sure if that's coming across, but I'm struck by that.
Well, I think it's great, but I also think in relation to Val's question, so there's this big picture, which I think science is telling us more and more or at least showing us how much we don't know. Okay, then you take it to the sense that in one century, we exploded as a species from 2 billion to 6 billion people, and now up to 7 billion people. So we are in one of the most fragmented moments in human history. I'm a historian. We're both historians of world religions. My grandfather was a historian of Europe and so on. The sense that we have exploded, we have overextended the population. Therefore, the resources are being used up, clearly, and contested. So that's the pragmatic side of where we are, and that we've got to reinvent ourselves, as Thomas said, as a species. We've got to reinvent ourselves as a species. And we've got to make this transition from a fossil fuel economy to alternative energies and so on. That is what is ahead of us. The most challenging thing that humans have ever faced. Can we actually create a multicultural planetary civilization that is not just sustainable but flourishing for all species? This is a big order. We don't know how to do it. We really don't have a map. There's confusion, there's chaos, there are polarizations of such immensity that we have never seen before.
Absolutely.
We won't mention all the political background about this, but I think we have the technical knowledge to do this. We have the sense of creating an economic system that's viable for alternative energies, viable for equity and justice issues, et cetera. We have the foundations for new and fresh educational ideas, for religious communities. That's what we've been working on and so on. We have a more integrated sense of science, a new ecology, as one of our colleagues here at Yale speaks about. So we have in place what Barry was calling for, creating the foundations for the ecozoic era, this new particular era. But it is going to be, it already is, massively painful, massively distressing. And we've got to allow ourselves to experience that, as Joanna Macy offered over and over again, despair and empowerment in the nuclear age. We've got to allow our students, next generations, into that sense of chaos and creativity, of despair and empowerment. They go together. We have to acknowledge that. And all the answers aren't going to be in a white paper, a blue paper, or one person, or in a central government. Much of this will be decentralized and move towards the center. And there are many people and institutions leading the way. I have great faith in that creativity of humans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think right now we're seeing a lot of what we're talking about in our circles, this level of awareness emerging of who we are, understanding ourselves in this richer context, even as we're in the midst of, you know, a mass extinction that we haven't seen in 65 million years, and global climate change, and coral reefs bleaching and dying out all over the ocean. I mean, things are very serious. And the pervasive paradigm, it has not quite caught up with the information that we've learned through science that has completely broken our hearts open and allowed us to get this and feel this on a much deeper level. So we are here, we're creating this. That, you know, part of the invitation of the summit is for us to step into this deeper understanding, because when we do, it really profoundly shifts our relationship to life. But we have a whole, we're like, I feel like we're just up against like 350 years of, you know, this mechanistic mentality, you know, that I don't want to say necessarily began with Descartes, but definitely was made, you know, world known through, you know, this scientific thought that rather than becoming useful in science became more of a world paradigm.
Right. And I think we have, you know, resources that I just mentioned of economics and technology and so on, but we have, as you're suggesting, this summit illustrates, we do have resources to move us even further into this notion of interdependence, interdependence from the universe story, and interconnection from the ecosystems on which we dwell and have our being. But the Earth Charter, I just wanted to put into the mix.
Yeah, can you talk about the Earth Charter a little bit, because I know you're part of that.
Well, I was involved for almost 10 years in the drafting process in the International Earth Charter Community and Committee. And that was an effort coming out of the Rio Earth Summit that was trying to find a way towards sustainable development, economics, and the environment. How do you integrate this? And that was a 92 Earth Summit. And Gorbachev said, we need a 10 commandments for the environment. We need principles, you see, to get us through. And we like to say principles, strategies, and tactics. Tactics being the action on the ground that comes out of a larger sense of principles. So the Earth Charter is the next stage. It's saying it's not just a declaration of independence that we need, but a declaration of interdependence. And so the preamble that I worked on with other scientists and so on is to say we're part of a vast evolving universe. The universe story is there right up front. And then ecology, justice, and peace are the pillars of this document, saying ecosystems are primary, justice for humans has got to be integrated into a flourishing Earth community, and peace and democracy are essential to realizing this. So the fact that we have this, that people from all over the world weighed in on this, women, business groups, indigenous peoples, it's a very inclusive process, and I think something that can help guide us forward.
Yes, and you can feel in the Earth Charter Thomas's critique of the industrial extractive system, but also a sense of the wisdom traditions that are there to help nurture and guide into uncertainty, a sense of the religions of the world and their wisdom tradition, the sense of the wisdom of women, and the wisdom of the science community, and finally the wisdom of indigenous traditions. And that the wisdom of indigenous traditions, I think of the Waco yarn painting over my shoulder here, this lovely sense of the birds who are bringing the basket and the sense of creative presence in the baskets delivered into the world. And the Earth Charter does have that sense also of delivering wisdom, opening voices. And I'm especially appreciative that Native indigenous people participated in the drafting of the Earth Charter. And in that phrase that Mary Evelyn mentions, that Earth itself is alive, filled with myriad forms of life. It's a very encouraging to reach back and understand how our ancestors and how contemporary indigenous people are still living with that realization of a living world.
Yeah, so Earth Charter, Journey of the Universe, process, thought, and theology, the religions coming into their ecological phase, all of this are reflecting this change of consciousness and conscience, a change of attitudes and worldviews that will bring us forward. How could you possibly destroy something that's alive, something that's kin? And I just want to mention this cosmology of the Confucian and Taoist worldview. This is the character for heaven, which actually means cosmos. But the three parts are heaven, earth, and human that's built into this. The idea is here, it's a human standing with their arms outspread with the cosmos over one. And the idea in this tradition is that we complete the cosmos and the dynamic earth systems with our action. We create societies that are equitable, that are inclusive, and so on. That's the ideal of a Confucian worldview, in this sense that we complete the macrocosm. We are the microcosm. All traditions have that sensibility. So again, this is a form of energy for the action, the great story for the great work.
Yeah, and to draw on that perspective too, and just to return to indigenous people, there's often a collapsing of indigenous perspectives using the term ecological as if there is some type of pristine or untrammeled relation with the natural world. But we know that all humans, including native peoples, have interacted with the world in dramatic ways and changing in very different ways. But what I find consistent is the sense of the views of nature found in the different species, in the different realms of the world itself. So there are views of nature. There's an openness in many traditions before our contemporary industrial extractive world that it's not just one nature that we're dealing with. It's not just one world. It's multiple worlds. And I'm not talking simply of multiverse or the concept of physics. I mean rather a sense that the rocks, the trees, water itself experiences the world and gives rise to a perspective on the world, at least according to indigenous perspectives. And I sense we're coming to our own realization of what that means in our encounter with the world. How do the elements themselves experience and configure themselves into a world that we also then experience?
Yeah,
I think we're seeing a real uprising in this too, with this movement. It's and you appreciate this from North Dakota. It was Standing Rock.
Exactly.
These indigenous cultures are coming together and putting aside their differences to stand for the one thing that unifies them. And you have all of these people now who, whatever their background was, is, it doesn't matter. They feel this connection. You know, yeah, that it's planet over profit, that there's a new story emerging that's really part of an ancient understanding married to the science of what we've learned in the last few hundred years coming together. And we're seeing this huge uprising just based on that deep feeling, that deep connected, interconnected sense of life and what's really important.
That's an excellent example. Even just to briefly say, from the Standing Rock perspective, the Hunkpapa and other Lakota peoples and many Native peoples gathering together, they did not choose the word resistance to characterize what it was that they were about, but rather protection.
Yes.
They saw themselves as water protectors. And that reaches into their cosmology, then their story of the world, that water is one of the nations among the different particular realities of the world, and that they stand in relationship, they stand in kinship with water. And that's a remarkable presence and a presence of mind. I heard one person who had come back from Standing Rock, and he made the comment, when you arrive at Standing Rock, you're welcomed that you're leaving America and coming into another realm. I think part of what he was suggesting is this story, this world of the protection of water is another way of thinking about this world we're engaging.
Yeah,
it does invite us into asking the question about what is the role of the human, right? And I know that that's also in the journey of the universe. You talk a little bit about that. I'd love to talk about that because it does invite us to reflect on what part we play, what part can we play.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to mention, I think Standing Rock illustrates what we can play, that yeah, we are protectors, that we are creators,
yes,
that we are people who will defend the earth and also defend those who are oppressed by climate change, by toxicity, Flint, Michigan, and so on. I mean, we are at a school of the environment that's over 100 years old, that we hear day in and day out the stories of the devastation that you've already mentioned. We're very, very aware of this. We're aware of environmental justice issues profoundly. Our students are very eager to address this issue to people and planet. We've worked to help promote the papal encyclical on the environment, which is definitely picking up actually some of Thomas Berry's ideas like integral ecology. How are people and the planet going to move forward? So there's a whole variety of roles that we can play. Everyone has a voice. Everyone has the sense of participating in transformative, and I will say positive change, not going backwards. But the range is enormous. And I think that's part of the creativity of our moment.
I appreciate the plural form when you asked, what are the roles of the human? Maybe you didn't. Maybe you said role, and I'm taking it to the plural because that would be my thinking along these lines. The world rises up and calls us into the roles that we will play. So it's not simply one. Maybe we can characterize them all as engaged. But despite the many roles, I would see them all as a celebratory. Also, our role as humans is to celebrate the world, to celebrate our presence in this world. And I felt, again, to return to the Standing Rock example, part of the power of that nonviolent movement was it was consistently marked by ritual activities, by spiritual presence, namely a celebratory commitment to the action.
Yeah, and I think it's why the Earth Charter gives us this branching into our roles. Ecology, the integrity of ecosystems, that has to be done by many, many people, scientists and non-scientists. Justice in societies, economic and social justice is absolutely critical. And without peace and nonviolence, such as was evident at Standing Rock, we won't move forward. The nonviolent, peaceful, prayerful dimension of Standing Rock is unbelievable and out there for everyone to see and to replicate and be inspired by.
Mm. And that's such an incredible discipline to abide in peacefulness in the midst of uncertainty. So many of the old stories, they read that challenge and they read it very powerfully. I'm thinking of the Navajo, the Dene twins, who come through so many challenges and move into uncertainty at one point by standing on an eagle feather and going off into the most difficult challenge. They experience the blue of the ocean meeting the blue of the sky, and they simply do not know what to do on their journey to their father. And they go off on their eagle feather saying, "We'll know where we're going when we get there." Mm. And that's, I feel that's part of what we're realizing also in our engagement today, that we just don't know what faces us, but we have some confidence to go ahead because it's no longer just a human burden, but it's rather a communion of subjects celebrating.
Yes. I love the way you worded that, John, about this invitation of celebration, you know, because I really do feel like it begins there with, you know, feeling and sensing and taking in the Earth's magnificence as a reflection of ourself.
Yes.
As us. And like when we get that, and I know we talked about this before, which is about, you know, it invites us to really fall in love with who we are as Earth, who we are as universe, this cosmological, you know, consciousness, this universe becoming aware of itself, exploring itself through the human form, like however we want to word that. When we get that as the kind of this first step of really breaking us open and understanding that, everything else follows. The unknown, the mystery, whatever's there, we can step into it with the confidence of billions of years within us.
Absolutely. And that confidence is the way Thomas Berry ends his new story essay, actually. Mm-hmm. And he says, if over billions of years, the galaxies and stars and planetary systems have emerged, if humans have emerged over this last 200,000 years as Homo sapiens, we should have confidence to move forward. It's a very powerful passage, but I love what you say. I love what John has said as well about the celebration, about the falling in love. And I just want to add this note that this is what she is, okay? In the East Asian world, everything is alive because it's matter and energy. And as we cultivate that through Tai Chi, through Qigong, through acupuncture and some word, we are becoming embedded in the flowing energy of all life. Because everything, birds, plants, all life forms have Qi, wind. So as we are participating in that, it's a celebratory act. It's a falling in love act, but it's also how we get our hands dirty in the ground act. All of this is part of drawing on the energy, the powers of the universe for the great work that needs to go forward.
Absolutely. And you know, you guys mentioned deep time. And I know I'm going to be talking, you know, Brian Swim is part of the summit and we're going to be diving in as well. But there's something lovely that he says, see if I can remember it exactly. Something like, if we wait long enough, we'll see the mountains galloping across the plains. And it's this idea, when we talk about sentience and life and animate and inanimate objects and the unfolding universe and the first cell and reflexive consciousness, all this stuff, right? This idea that you know, the mountains begin to crumble into the soil, which feeds the carrot, which the horse comes by and eats, and it becomes part of the horse's body and gallops across the plains. That when we get out of our short-term thinking, like the, let's say on the 100 years lifespan that we have, and we really start to think in terms of deep time and feel in terms of deep time, how it shifts our relationship to what being alive really means.
Exactly. And I think looking behind us at this painting, a Japanese painting, which is trying to capture the chi, the energy of these crayfish, and the idea, the aesthetics of this whole art of painting, of black and white painting like this, is you are seeing the chi in the world, and that's what you're painting. It's not the description or the realism, but you are cultivating yourself by being in resonance with that matter energy. That's what chi is, material force, vital energy, matter energy. It overcomes the dualism that we've been so stuck with. And I think we're bursting out of that dualism. The Chinese character for mind and heart is one. And we as humans are one loving and reflexive consciousness of the whole universe. That's the Confucian worldview, that we complete and reflect upon and create the future destiny, actually, of the universe.
And we have elders who model these insights in their lives. And I'm struck by the question that Thomas Berry was pushed in his final days as he was dying. He was asked, "Where will you be, Thomas, after you die?" And without a moment's hesitation, he said, "I'll be where I've always been, right here in the universe." And I reflect on that answer, and I feel, Val, your comment earlier about the mountains galloping across the plains, that sense of the universe constantly transforming itself, the transmutation, we are that universe, and we are, as the Irish are wont to say, in the Cura of Kildare, that beautiful plain in the central part of Ireland, where it's that's the voice of the people in that long plain where we're galloping across. That's also the journey of the universe, that long plain.
Yes, it is. And I love this, and this idea too, like thinking about death and birth and the transition of energy and, you know, the movement of it all, you know, and just how even like when our bodies die, and this is so healthy for us to think about this, that, you know, then we're eaten by all these little creatures and we live on inside of them, becoming part of their bodies and becoming part of the soil, and, you know, that we're always just here. What a beautiful poetic thing for Thomas Berry to say. I'm where I've always been, here in the universe. Yes, I'm really feeling into that.
How do you see the obsession with zombies and ghouls in our time in relationship to the a sense of an understanding of the world and the food of the world? It seems we are, as a culture, in a very different place than welcoming the food of the world and the eating of the world.
It's interesting that you ask that, because I actually had this conversation not too long ago with somebody, this obsession with zombies right now. And I really feel like it's somehow, it's this like deeper subconscious, I don't know what you want to say, explosion or storytelling, if you will, of our own zombification in our culture, not feeling, not thinking, numbing out. I see it as that more than anything right now, that there's this deep sense of ignorance. There's a deep sense of, I don't want to say, like, you know, people have fallen victim to the multi-billion-dollar industry that's out there to get you not to think and to tell you what to feel or not to feel, or to escape from this and escape from that. And we're just running away from immersing ourselves in life.
I believe so. I think we're moving through this sense of a use categorization, where we've used the world, and we now see the world rising up saying to us, "You used me." And Thomas would make that statement. It's such an arresting moment to feel that pain of someone saying to us, "You used me." And yet it seems to me we have to go through that realization, just as we have to acknowledge civil rights, we have to acknowledge our exchange with Native peoples, we have to reconnect with the world by facing up to our journey, our own cultural, local journey.
I'd love to pick up on that and maybe move towards our work in Journey of the Universe. And just a summary here. Would that be the appropriate moment to do that, Val?
Yeah, please.
So we just want to explain, to take this forward, what we've been doing with Journey of the Universe, the film and the book and the conversations, is we've made them available now on massive open online classes. Journey of the Universe, as you know, was on PBS for 3 years, won an Emmy in Northern California. The book is now downloadable from Yale Press, and so are the conversations, 20 conversations, interviews I did with scientists and environmentalists and so on. So there's 4 courses altogether. The first one is the film and book of the universe. The second is the conversations. And the third is this underlying inspiration of Thomas Berry, the worldview of Thomas Berry. And the fourth is a capstone if you want to complete the 4 for a specialization. So the URL will be available for you. These are free, or the audit option, on Coursera. So they're Yale courses on Coursera. They're only 6 weeks, but you can finish them as you wish over 6 months if you wish. So you have to sign up each month. There's a new cohort that emerges. But we invite you to take these courses. Brian is part of them as well, and we're thrilled that our work with Brian and Thomas and Teilhard de Chardin and many scientists and many of you have helped in this work, the collective work, that it may go forward. People around the world are now watching it. Many, many people, 13,000 actually at the moment, just over a few months' time.
So yes, we're definitely going to have a link below the video so everybody can click on that and find out more information, because it's going to be so rich having years ago, you know, I read the book, I have the book, I have the videos, I have the educational series, I have everything, because this, you know, cosmology is such a fascinating subject for me, because it is what we are. I mean, I feel like we should all be captivated by it, because we're just learning about ourselves. Isn't that what we're always doing in life, right? So this to me is the deepest conversation. So I really recommend that everybody, you know, jump in. If it's not the course, at least get the video, get the book, and really take this in. Because in it, you get into, you guys, Brian Smith, into the unfolding universe story. So we really get into the details and the magic of how life came together and created itself and continued to evolve, and the first single cell and consciousness. And there's just so much woven into it. There's so many statements in the book that it's all underlined. I have to keep underlining it because it's so poetic and it's so rich. And there's so much that just gets inside your heart and helps you recognize who you are in the deepest level.
Well, thank you so much for letting us share our ideas, our enthusiasm, and the work that you're doing. And we really wish you well as it goes forward.
Yes, all best to the summit.
Thank you so much, you guys. It's really been a joy to have you, and just so grateful for you in this world and the way you're bringing us deeper into ourselves. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.